Chapter 4. The End of Sex. I didn't confess everything in the introduction to this book. I stopped the tale prematurely. I hid a word. The doctor at the cryobank told me that the sprightly receptionist, who also functioned as the nurse, would take me back to the masturbatorium. It's a real term. I blushed a little as she led me through the corridor and handed me a plastic container. She opened the door to a small room that must have once been a broom closet. Sterile white and dominated by a medical supply cabinet, the only indication of the room's purpose was a porn video already playing on the TV. I wondered if someone had profiled me when choosing which DVD to slot in. Did something about me suggest tattoos? "The magazines are on this rack," she said in a professional tone, pointing to a stack of well-worn magazines. "If you don't like this one, the other DVDs are in this drawer organized by type. Just place your deposit in the container and seal the lid tightly. Leave the specimen on the counter when you're done, and I'll pick it up. Anything else you need?" I shook my head. A hole to crawl into? As she stepped out and closed the door behind her, I looked around the strange room, feeling ill at ease amid the faint drone of low-volume grunting. Was this really what evolution had in mind for me? There were few environments I could imagine less conducive to the task at hand than this. A dentist's chair came to mind. But, as awkward as it was, I'd returned to work before my lunch break ended. It really wasn't all that bad. That's because I'm a man. The average healthy male produces more than 500 billion sperm cells over the course of his life, with between 40 million and 1.2 billion sperm cells being released each ejaculation. Like many other mammalian species, we produce so much sperm because we've been competing with other males for hundreds of millions of years to get our sperm as close as possible to the desired female's eggs. The way our species is built, male sperm is a dime a dozen. That's why the masturbatorium is a thinly disguised broom closet with no technology to speak of other than the television and a Y2K-era DVD player. But for women, the story is different. Human women are born with about 2 million egg follicles that will, over time, turn into eggs. Most of these follicles close up before puberty, leaving only about 300 to 400 with the potential over the coming few decades to mature into eggs available for fertilization. That's a big difference. About 500 billion total sperm cells for men, up to 400 total eggs for women. In contrast to the ease of extracting male sperm, extracting a human female egg is anything but. When having her eggs retrieved for IVF, a woman must first endure up to 5 weeks of sex hormone pills and/or injections to make sure she develops a maximal number of follicles and eggs for retrieval. These ovary-stimulating drugs ramp up estrogen levels and not only can cause nausea, bloating, headaches, blurred vision, and hot flashes, but also increase the woman's risk for dangerous blood clots and ovarian hyperstimulation. Using ultrasound to monitor the development of the woman's eggs attached to the follicle wall in her ovaries, IVF doctors wait until the follicles have reached maturity before anesthetizing the woman for the egg retrieval procedure. A needle is then passed through the top of the vagina to reach into the ovary to vacuum out the egg, which is then placed in a plastic dish. After the woman emerges from sedation and rests, she is usually sent home, where she can expect some cramping for at least a few hours, but sometimes longer. Millions of women endure the pain and potential, though rare, danger of egg retrieval because the promise in their minds of motherhood outweighs this inconvenience. But that doesn't make the process any less difficult. IVF is not impossible, but it is certainly not easy. It is also less emotionally appealing and more clinical than conception by sex. conception by sex will always have emotional appeal, and some of us will always trust 3.8 billion years of evolution more than we do our local fertility doctors. But with its mix of costs and benefits, IVF will increasingly compete with sex as the primary way we humans procreate, particularly as it increasingly comes to be seen as safer and more versatile. Since the birth of Louise Brown in 1978, more than 8 million IVF babies have been born with no discernibly different health outcomes than other babies. In the United States, around 1.5% of all babies are born with IVF. In Japan, the number has risen to nearly 5%. The use of IVF hasn't just helped older or higher-risk mothers conceive, but has also helped new categories of people, including many gay and lesbian couples, have their own biologically related children. Starting in the 1980s and 90s, fertility services, donor insemination, surrogacy, and changing social norms paved the way for more gay and lesbian couples to have children of their own in the United States and some other countries. The historic 2015 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, declaring gay marriage protected by the Constitution, further facilitated this increasing normalization of the gay family. With today's technology, gay men who want to have a biologically half-related child generally need to find a donor for the egg that will often be fertilized by one of the men's sperm and then gestated in a surrogate. Lesbian couples need, of course, a male sperm donor. This means that for the estimated 4% of the population who self-described to Gallup as being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, LGBT, assisted reproduction is already not the exception, but the norm. As in other areas, the LGBT community stands at the vanguard of social change. For IVF to become a more common way for all women to conceive, this kind of different thinking about conception will need to go even more mainstream. The IVF model will also need to become easier, less clinical, and less painful for women, a process already well underway. Imagine you are wanting another child in 2045, a decade after your second was born. You are a busy executive with every moment of your day scheduled to the brink. You are proud of your and your partner's ancestry and want to have your own 100% biologically related child. Your experience selecting what still feel like positive traits for your second child reaffirmed your data-driven instincts, so this time you don't have many reservations about selecting your embryo prior to implantation with as much genetic information as possible. You are willing to get pregnant because you want to make sure your future child is looked after in utero, even though lots of other people are hiring gestational surrogates and a few are experimenting with synthetic wombs. But you'd still like to make the process as easy as possible, so long as it delivers the maximum benefit. Luckily, you don't have to go through the difficult egg retrieval process because now you can hack your reproductive process more than you'd ever imagined possible. You are leading your morning staff meeting at work when your assistant comes into your office and places a small touch-activated phlebotomy or TAP device on your arm. You don't feel a thing and continue with your presentation as the device suctions 100 milliliters of your blood, the equivalent of about 7 tablespoons, into a small receptacle. That's it. In just this moment, you've achieved more than was ever possible with the old IVF egg retrieval model, based on another wonder of human imagination and scientific progress, unlocking the magic of stem cells. The work of scientists like Magnifico Spallanzani showed that human reproduction happens when a male sperm cell fertilizes a female egg cell. If we start as one fertilized egg cell, which then differentiates into the many different types of cells that make up a person, then it logically follows that those early cells must be able to grow out of the initial cell-like plants from a seed. But how? It was not coincidental that when, in 1908, Russian scientist Alexander A. Maximov described a precursor cell that could develop into any other type of cell, he used a plant analogy. Over the ensuing years, scientists learned more about these amazing stem cells that both grow into the many different types of cells it takes to make an organism, and then, in a more specialized form, continue regenerating each type of cell to keep the organism going. Stem cells are the seeds that later become the enablers of the branches. For decades, researchers struggled trying to understand, identify, and isolate stem cells. Then, in 1981, British researchers Martin Evans and Matthew Kaufman were the first to extract these stem cells from mouse embryos, a process first carried out on human embryos by two different teams of American researchers 17 years later. The discovery of human embryonic stem cells launched a tidal wave of anticipation, first among scientists and then among the general public. In 1998, University of Wisconsin developmental biologist Jamie Thompson and Johns Hopkins University's John Gearhart, both leading human embryonic stem cell researchers, described to CNN the many miracles stem cells might unleash. They could, Thompson and Gearhart claimed, be used to repair spinal injuries, heart muscle cells after heart attacks, and organs damaged by disease or radiation, spur insulin production to treat diabetes and brain cells to secrete dopamine to treat Parkinson's disease, and to genetically alter blood cells to resist diseases like HIV. The idea of using embryonic stem cells to deliver these kinds of miracles enthralled many around the world, but terrified others. Embryonic stem cells are, as their name implies, derived from embryos. These embryos, in nearly all cases, are unimplanted embryos from fertility clinics. For those believing life begins at conception, these early-stage embryos in petri dishes were people. If so, destroying discarded embryos to support cutting-edge research, even to discover life-saving treatments, was nothing short of murder. America's Right to Life movement quickly targeted stem cell biology. Suddenly, stem cells are everywhere, Time magazine reported in July 2001. Once relegated to the depths of esoteric health journals, the microscopic clusters have made their way to the nation's front pages and become the political cause du jour in Washington. The debate surrounding the cells threatens to rend traditional alliances, challenging our comprehension of life and leaving some abortion opponents in a very uncomfortable spot. Is it possible to protect the strict boundaries inherent in the sanctity of life and still harvest these cells to help the living among us? Some pro-life advocates have likened using stem cells for research to what Nazi doctors did during World War II. But these cells also hold great promise for millions of ailing patients and their families. Caught between scientific advancement and his conservative base, and between the conflicting views of different members of his own cabinet, U.S. President George W. Bush split the difference. On August 9, 2001, he announced a ban on federal funding for research involving newly created human embryonic stem cell lines. This meant that the 71 stem cell lines that met the U.S. government's criteria that were already in use by researchers could still be accessed. Any researchers using new or other human stem cell lines, however, could not receive U.S. government funding. The Bush administration's Solomonic effort pleased no one. For advocates of stem cell research, limiting the number of available stem cell lines only slowed essential research likely to save and improve countless lives. For many opponents, the use of any embryonic stem cell lines violated the sanctity of life and was an abomination. Some U.S. researchers decamped to countries like Singapore and the United Kingdom to continue their research with fewer restrictions. Activists in New York and California countered the Bush administration restrictions by creating well-funded, state-based research support organizations, the New York Stem Cell Foundation and the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. But then, a discovery in a somewhat obscure Japanese research institute blew open the doors of stem cell research and transformed our concept of biological plasticity forever. Most of us think of biology as a process that moves forward linearly. We start as a single cell and then grow into complex beings. We are born, we age, then we die. But nature sometimes hides its tricks in plain sight. We wouldn't expect to make perfectly fresh cheese from old milk, but it seems perfectly normal to us that 2 30-year-old adult humans can have a child who is born 0 years old, not 30 or 60. Clearly, our cells already have a way of resetting the clock. In the 1950s, Oxford biologist John Gurdon was thinking about how certain animal cells seem to rejuvenate themselves. He wondered if cells already specialized, as skin or liver or other types of adult cells, might retain a latent ability to revert to their pre-differentiated state. To test this hypothesis, he replaced the nucleus of a frog egg cell with one from a fully mature and specialized frog cell. After a series of these, literally, adulterated egg cells failed to do much of anything after being inseminated with frog sperm, a few, miraculously, became fertilized, and healthy tadpoles were created. Gurdon proved that any adult cell, under the right circumstances, had the innate ability to go back in developmental time to become the equivalent of an embryonic stem cell. Gurdon's incredible discovery opened researchers' minds to the possibility of cells behaving like Benjamin Buttons, but didn't provide a blueprint for how to make that happen. Japanese veterinary researcher Shinya Yamanaka was determined to find it. As a child in Osaka, Yamanaka enjoyed taking clocks and radios apart and putting them back together. After beginning his career as a surgeon, his frustration that he was unable to heal some of the worst diseases facing his patients inspired him to seek a deeper understanding of cell biology. He went back to school to get his PhD in pharmacology, with a particular focus on mouse genetics. When he learned of Jamie Thompson's work generating human stem cells and John Gurdon's findings on how nuclear DNA can be reprogrammed, he set his heart on deciphering the hidden potencies of cells. After years of painstaking research, in 2006, Yamanaka and his team discovered that proteins encoded by just 4 master genes could turn back the clock and transform any adult cell back into a stem cell. Just as a stem cell could differentiate itself forward in developmental time into a skin, blood, liver, heart, or any other of the 200 types of human cells, these Yamanaka factors could revert any skin, blood, liver, or other type of cell back into the equivalent of an embryonic stem cell. He called these induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs. Yamanaka deconstructed the cell and showed how the biological clock could tick backward. Yamanaka and Gurdon won the 2012 Nobel Prize because their discoveries have the potential to revolutionize much of biology, including how we humans create eggs. In 2012, Japanese cell biologists Katsuhiko Hayashi and Mitanori Saito announced they had used the Yamanaka factors to reprogram adult mouse skin cells in a dish into iPS cells. They then added more chemicals to turn these stem cells into egg and sperm progenitor cells, the precursors of eggs and sperm. After they placed the same artificial cells into mouse ovaries, the cells matured into eggs. When they put induced sperm precursor into mouse testes, These cells matured into sperm. These induced eggs and sperm were used for mouse IVF, resulting in perfectly healthy baby mice. Even though the success rate for these iPSC-generated sperm and eggs in IVF was extremely low, this was a spectacular breakthrough. Sperm and eggs had been generated from skin cells and used to give birth to healthy mice. 2 years later, in 2014, scientists in England and Israel figured out a way to replicate the same finding, but they made human egg and sperm cells out of adult skin cells in a dish. The efficiency of this process was, again, extremely low. Then, in September 2018, Saito and his collaborators announced they had induced egg precursor cells from human blood cells, which were then incubated in tiny ovaries developed from mouse embryonic cells. Even though these induced human egg precursor cells were not mature enough for human fertilization, reaching that point was tantalizingly near. Although the large number of unknowns still makes this procedure not at all safe for humans in the near term, the science is improving fast, and the implications are massive for the future of human reproduction and your experience in the 2045 clinic. The average woman who has her eggs extracted yields about 15 eggs for potential fertilization. Because some of the eggs often prove unfit for fertilization, or because the embryos have one problem or another, a large attrition rate is normal for IVF. The number of early-stage embryos actually available for selection is, therefore, significantly lower than 15. But induced stem cell technology could multiply that number in a very big way. That 100 milliliters of blood your assistant took during your meeting contains around 300 million peripheral blood mononuclear cells, or PBMCs, blood cells with a cell nucleus. Each of these PBMCs, or any other type of adult cell for that matter, can be transformed by Yamanaka factors into induced stem cells. Then, using the process Hayashi and Saito developed, each of these millions of stem cells could be turned into egg precursor cells, and ultimately, into eggs. Now, you have hundreds or thousands or even millions of eggs. The father's sperm cells already number in the hundreds of millions. But even if the father's sperm is not at first available or he is infertile, the same process could be used to generate sperm from iPS cells. Put the sperms and eggs together in a dish at the right temperature, or inject the sperm cells into the eggs, and now, instead of around 15 fertilized eggs, you have hundreds or thousands. Then the lab can use advanced AI tools to machine sort the fertilized eggs to identify those with optimal shapes and biologies, the technological version of what embryologists do manually in fertility clinics today. The next step would be to grow these fertilized eggs for 5 to 7 days until each is about 100 cells, and then extract 5 or so cells from each blastocyst and sequence them. Because the cost of sequencing a genome will soon be largely negligible, sequencing these early-stage embryos will be cheap, easy, and quick. And because low-cost universal sequencing, paired with electronic medical and life records and big data analytics, will by then have unlocked far more secrets of the human genome, the information these 100 embryos each provide will be astonishing by today's standards. It will likely be a normal component of the baby-making process then, as you experience in 2045. In the weeks since the drone messenger picked up your blood sample, you've been living your normal life, but your blood sample has been experiencing a metamorphosis. At the clinic, Yamanaka factors are used to turn your blood cells into induced pluripotent stem cells. These stem cells are induced into egg precursor cells, just like the ones you produced inside your body when you went through IVF a decade ago. Only this time, many more eggs are being created outside your body than you ever could have produced within. You've been feeling a growing sense of excitement. You've been talking about the possibilities of a third child for years, but your big day is finally here. This is a hypothetical, so we can experiment with who we slot into this story in the role of your partner. It could be your husband, but also potentially anybody else. We could imagine a version where two men could have their own 100% biologically related babies using the sperm of one father and eggs induced from an adult cell taken from the other father. Or both the egg and sperm might conceivably be generated from the same man who would become the father and the mother of his child, a scenario seeming more feasible than ever before. American scientists have already produced viable offspring from two male mice. In November 2018, Chinese scientists announced they had successfully and efficiently harvested stem cells from a mouse egg that they induced into sperm cells used to fertilize the eggs of another female mouse, resulting in healthy mouse pups with half their genetics coming from the first mother and the other half from the second mother. Recent research has pointed to the distinct possibility of generating eggs from 3D-printed ovaries that could be filled with follicles and implanted into a man or transgender woman. Don't start purchasing your male maternity clothes just yet, but biology is certainly not what it used to be. On the big day, you wait expectantly in the clinic to be called. The waiting room has been redecorated since your last visit a decade ago. Settling into the lush sofa under the soft lights with gentle spa-style music playing, you feel secure with the choice you've made to stick with this clinic, now part of a larger brand competing in this $50 billion assisted reproduction technologies U.S. business sector. The door opens, and the doctor comes in to greet you. The office walls are now made up of large screens. She has chosen a beach motif, and as you sit, it feels like you are relaxing at a table on the waterfront. The sound of gentle waves soothes you. You appreciate the effort, but have bigger things on your mind. You've now been exposed to scientifically assisted reproduction for 2 decades and have 2 wonderful kids, your healthy and robust 20-year-old, now at college, and your brilliant, artistic, and optimistic 10-year-old at home. This time you don't need any convincing. "Well?" you ask expectantly. "Okay," she says. "Let's get down to it. Your blood sample arrived safely 1 week ago. We spun your blood in a centrifuge to extract the cells we needed, then reprogrammed them into the stem cells we used to create the egg precursor cells, and then your eggs. We decided to fertilize 1,000 of your eggs, but then machine-sorted those 1,000 down to the 100 we grew into 6-day-old embryos. We then extracted 5 cells from each of these blastocysts for sequencing, and the result is..." This is the moment you've been waiting for. You hold your breath. Suddenly, the beach scene goes away, and the walls become a massive grid filled with numbers between 0 and 100. Your eyes scan the room in awe as you stand and look around. "This may seem a bit confusing," the doctor says, "but the chart shows the probabilities for each of your 100 embryos having the listed outcomes. The y-axis lists your early-stage embryos from 1 to 100. The x-axis lists the estimated percentage chance each embryo will have a specific condition or trait should that embryo become a person." There are so many different traits the chart wraps around the entire room. "This is incredible. The science is advancing so fast. Welcome to the future of human reproduction," she says. You walk over and point to the column under the heading Alzheimer's. "So the 90 in this column means that these embryos would have a 90% chance of getting Alzheimer's during their lifetimes?" "Actually, no," she replies. "All of the numbers are relative to what's considered the more positive outcome. That 90% means that embryo would have a 90% chance of not getting Alzheimer's if it were selected. The higher numbers are generally what you would likely want for a given trait." I see, you say, and this one would be a great sprinter? He, that embryo's male, would have a genetic proclivity for fast twitch muscles, and of course, to be a great sprinter, he'd need to have a high score for determination, as well as train, eat well, be exposed to positive role models, etc., whatever the genes say. You scan the walls in awe, and then it hits you. My mother always used to tell me that I was perfect just as I was. I just need to reiterate, the doctor says, that these are all your natural children, just the same as if you had conceived through sex, just the same as when you went through IVF and embryo selection last time, when the number of eggs was limited by your natural ability to produce them. We've only increased the number of options. All of these qualities, the good ones and the dangerous ones, are all your genetic inheritance. They all reflect the genetics of you and your partner's ancestors going back billions of years. Change is hard for all of us, but the ultimate question people are asking is whether they feel better off with all these choices or better off the old way, where so much was left to chance. Am I really just shooting for a high composite score? You ask, still struggling with the idea that the magic of life can be reduced to a series of percentages on a graph. Nature is no fool, the doctor replies thoughtfully. Evolution isn't random. It just made some trade-offs for us over the years that today don't always seem that great. We have to approach all of this with a great deal of humility. You look around the room at the cascade of numbers and don't see humility. There's a 10% chance some of your embryos won't get type 1 diabetes, a 20% chance some won't get Alzheimer's. Something still doesn't feel right. You've always known that people with genetic disorders were just different. Some of them, like some people with autism, even have superpowers far beyond their so-called normal peers. What does it mean to select these conditions out with a simple nod of the head? But you also realize these aren't just numbers on a wall. You close your eyes and imagine your future grandchildren holding your third child's hand as her mind deteriorates from Alzheimer's or weeping at the cemetery after her premature death. Would you play Russian roulette with your next child's fate by not affirmatively selecting health? Would you even consider not giving your child the best genetic possibilities that your and your partner's genes make possible? If this is hubris, you realize, sign me up. What's the next step? The doctor leans in. First, we should eliminate all the embryos with high likelihoods of having major diseases. That means the ones with 0 to 50 in the disease state columns. With so many possible choices, why select embryos so likely to suffer? There goes Kafka and Van Gogh, you think to yourself. And then? There are so many traits influenced in one way or another by genes. The algorithm in this chart weighs each trait by our level of confidence in how important genetic factors are for the trait. For hair and eye color, for example, there's an almost 100% certainty that your genes determine the outcome. For some of the other traits, take musical ability, for example, we only have a 50% confidence the genes we've identified are impactful. So where does that leave us? You need to make hard choices in ranking your priorities, the doctor continues. Picking everything is kind of like picking nothing. If empathy is really important to you, put that in your highest category. If being a good marathon runner with slow twitch muscles is nice but not that important to you, put that lower so you don't skew the results. Do you follow? You hardly answer. Your mind is already transfixed in the range of possible futures playing out on the wall. You take in a deep breath. Shall we begin? Your mind reaches back to the choices our species has already made. To understand how far selective breeding can take us, we only need to look in our refrigerators. A wild chicken lays only about one egg a month for some very good reasons. As a species that, unlike salmon, actually raises its young, wild chickens can't produce many more offspring than they are able to rear. Reproduction takes a lot of energy, so laying more eggs would also place more pressure on wild chickens to secure a steady stream of food. And laying a lot of eggs would make wild chickens even more susceptible to lurking predators. For fertile wild females, laying about an egg a month represents a balancing act of evolutionary imperatives played out over millions of years. Around 8,000 years ago, humans first domesticated chickens from an Asian red jungle fowl called the Gallus gallus. It didn't take Gregor Mendel's meticulous mind or PhDs in genetics for our ancestors to observe which of their newly domesticated chickens were laying the most eggs. It didn't take an IVF clinic or even a galline dating app for farmers to breed the chickens laying the most eggs. Using little science to speak of, our ancestors used selective breeding to amplify a chicken trait that had emerged over millions of years of evolution. Today, each American consumes an average of 268 eggs per year, amounting to a total U.S. egg consumption of nearly 87 billion a year, produced by around 270 million hens hatching on average one egg a day. Nearly 1.2 trillion eggs are consumed globally each year, produced by a worldwide army of 50 billion domesticated chickens. Many have come to see the large numbers of chicken farms around the world producing these eggs as a dangerous and dirty nuisance. Imagine what would happen if these domesticated chickens were laying eggs at the same rate as their wild forebears. Instead of 50 billion chickens in farms around the world, we'd need around 775 billion chickens. Imagine how people would feel. Earth would become a planet of chickens. Because the Gallus gallus still runs wild in Southeast Asian forests, it is easy to compare domesticated chickens with their wild ancestors, just as it is easy to compare domesticated dogs and the wolves from which they came. In addition to laying more eggs, domesticated chickens are less aggressive and more social, active, and mobile. As with our other domesticated animals and plants, humans have successfully hacked the chicken. If we got in our time machine and went back 8,000 years to visit those first chicken-domesticating humans and asked them how many eggs a chicken might lay, they would have been hard-pressed to envision 30 a month. 30 eggs a month would have sounded then as crazy as a woman today having 30 babies in 9 months. The point here is that biology is significantly more susceptible to hacking than initially meets the eye. We know this intuitively because all of the complex life forms around us evolved from the same origin. But the chicken example suggests that even our own biology might potentially be more manipulable by selective breeding than we are often inclined to believe. With chickens as a backdrop, now let's look at another organism we will want to hack so it can live longer, healthier, or however we might define it, better. Homo sapiens, like you and me, come with time-limited hardware and some very buggy software. Most of the cells in our body turn over, on average, every 2 years. As we continually copy and recreate ourselves through the magic of our stem cells, small errors start showing up in the genetic code of our new cells. At first, this doesn't hurt us much, because we have the machinery inside our cells to fix the errors or keep them from causing damage. But as we get older, the number of these errors increases, and our ability to fight them declines. We call some of these bugs aging, and others cancer. As we've come to understand these bugs over the past 150 years, we've also developed some preliminary hacks that allow us to fight back. That's what we're doing every time we treat a genetic disease. When someone gets a bone marrow transplant, for example, doctors destroy their faulty hematopoietic, blood-forming cells using radiation and then repopulate the patient with healthy cells from a donor. But if the underlying problem is a heritable genetic disease, the children of even a person cured by a bone marrow transplant could inherit the same problem. But what if we wanted to push genetic change, like eliminating genetic diseases or enhancing certain traits through our own species as thoroughly as we've pushed increased egg production through chickens? What if we come to see our current biology like our ancestors once saw chickens laying an egg a month, a challenge to be overcome by human ingenuity and selective breeding? The first problem we'd need to overcome would be time, because we humans are just a slow-breeding species. We enter the world completely helpless and unable to care for ourselves, and spend years learning which way is up. At some point in our early teens, some of us begin to recognize there's something different about members of the opposite sex, but we're not quite sure what it is. Terror sets in when some of us realize in our early teens that we need to figure out how the opposite sex works, because someday we may need OMG to have children with them. We start the process of dating with pimpled awkwardness, but then, in our later teens and early 20s, tend to get the hang of it. Having so much fun, we then don't want to end the run prematurely, and often aspire to meet enough people to make a smart choice. Finally, at an average age of 27.5 for women and 29.5 for men in the United States, and a bit lower worldwide, humans get married. At an average of around 28 in the United States and 26 globally, women have their first child, and the process starts again. 28 years for humans to pass a generation, 6 months for chickens. That's a big reason why pushing genetic change in chickens can be far quicker than in slow-breeding animals like us. But what if we could speed up that process to reduce the human generational turnover to about the same 6 months as a chicken, not by making babies mature faster, but by breeding pre-implanted embryos with each other? The idea sounds straight out of dystopian science fiction, but could someday in the not-too-distant future be possible. Imagine we start by taking the mother's blood sample and then induce her peripheral blood mononuclear cells into stem cells and then into hundreds of eggs. We then fertilize the eggs with the father's sperm and select one embryo based on whatever criteria. But now, rather than implanting that early-stage embryo in the mother, we instead extract a few cells from it to generate new sex cells. Let's make these new sex cells eggs for the purposes of this hypothetical. Now imagine that another mother and father went through the exact same process, but instead of inducing eggs from the cells extracted from their pre-implanted embryo, they create sperm. If we use this second embryo's sperm to fertilize the first embryo's eggs, then the embryos become the biological parents of their offspring, and the original two sets of fathers and mothers become the grandparents. This grandchild embryo could then be mated with another embryo with an entirely different set of parents and grandparents, now making the original mothers and father great-grandparents, and the original pre-implanted embryo's grandparents. This process could, theoretically at least, go on forever. Of course, finding the right embryo to mate with yours and avoiding inbreeding would require a process for pre-implanted embryos equivalent to that used by mate-seeking adults today. Perhaps someday an app could be created to help parents find the perfect mate for their precious little pre-implanted embryo. For technical reasons, this process would take about 6 months per generation, and conceivably could go on forever. 6-month-old embryos could become genetic parents. Year-old frozen embryos, or 3-month-old babies, could become grandparents. Using this process would mean we could pass 56 human generations over the same 28 years it now takes for one, equivalent of the generational distance between us and Kublai Khan. Rather than 3.5 human generations in a century, we could go through 200. That number of current human generations would bring us back to just when the wheel was being invented. Sped up by genome sequencing and biological systems analysis driving decisions instead of old-fashioned trial and error, generation change through selective breeding in humans might start seeming as malleable for us as it's been for chickens. But why might people in the future even consider something as frightening and dehumanizing as breeding human embryos to push genetic changes as we have chickens? They might not, and this potentially feasible process might remain just a thought experiment. But future generations also might look at the numbers. We've already heard that IQ is influenced by hundreds or even thousands of genes, in most cases each with a relatively small effect. We've also seen that people with higher IQs tend to live longer, earn more, and have more fulfilling relationships than their lower IQ peers, so we know that some parents would conceivably have an incentive to endow their children with the greatest IQ potential possible if they had the choice and believed it was safe. In their thought-provoking paper, Embryo Selection for Cognitive Enhancement, Curiosity or Game Changer?, Oxford professors Carl Schulman and Nick Bostrom attempt to quantify what increase in IQ might be possible based on mating unimplanted embryos with each other. The IQ of a traditionally conceived child, an N of 1, simply has the genetic component of IQ he or she is born with. Because the genetic component of IQ varies among embryos created by the same parents, other than identical twins, we can safely assume the range of IQ options would be greater the larger the number of embryos that might be generated. This means that we would have a greater chance of selecting an unimplanted embryo with a higher IQ if the number of options was larger. According to Schulman and Bostrom's calculations, the average IQ difference between the highest and lowest IQ of the 15 or so embryos conceived in IVF, as practiced today, from the same parents, would be about 12 points. But if we use the induced stem cell procedure to start with 100 fertilized eggs rather than just 10 or 15, the average difference between the highest and lowest genetic IQ potentials between these 100 options is estimated at about 20 points. Making 1,000 embryos could increase the average differential between the highest and lowest IQ of all the embryos to about 25 points. 25 IQ points may seem like a small return from generating and testing 1,000 pre-implanted embryos, but that difference would, on average, lead to vastly different life experiences. Einstein was estimated to have an IQ of 160. Arnold Schwarzenegger, not an Einstein but no dummy himself, has an estimated IQ of 135. Enough said. When we explore the mathematics of mating these already highly selected embryos with each other, the numbers start to look astounding. Schulman and Bostrom estimate that breeding 5 generations of embryos picked for having the highest IQ among their 10 cohorts could create a bump up of 65 points in IQ and a 130-point bump after 10 generations. 130 IQ points is the difference between an Einstein and a person with severe intellectual disabilities who requires constant care. In the other direction, it's the difference between an Einstein and someone with, by far, the highest IQ ever recorded. Stephen Sue is even more optimistic about how much of a bump might be possible. Normally, some human genes have either a positive or a negative effect on intelligence, resulting in a normal curve of intelligence. If each of these genes is tweaked to have a positive effect, then the aggregate effect could be a human with a much higher level of intelligence than the 100 standard deviation IQ average. Sue believes that because we will likely be able to identify most of the genes associated with intelligence within a decade, parents in the future might be able to select between pre-implanted embryos based on the expression of genes associated with intelligence to create a super-intelligent person with an IQ of 1,000. Hidden in these calculations of multiples and averages is the increasing possibility that future children with truly outstanding outlier capabilities, such as a genius for math, making music, or writing advanced computer code, might revolutionize our ways of thinking even more than our greatest geniuses like Einstein, Confucius, Marie Curie, Isaac Newton, Shakespeare, and David Hasselhoff. We can imagine savant-like capabilities, Sue writes, that in a maximal type might be present all at once, nearly perfect recall of images and language, super-fast thinking and calculation, powerful geometric visualization, even in higher dimensions, the ability to execute multiple analyses or trains of thought in parallel at the same time. The list goes on. Of course, we have no idea what an IQ of 1,000 would mean for a person. Evolution is full of redundancies, protections, and trade-offs. It is very possible, perhaps even likely, that a person engineered to have a 1,000 IQ might be driven crazy, become a dangerous sociopath, or develop some type of neurological malady we've never seen. It would be extremely difficult to know what harmful mutations were being pushed across multiple generations of embryos mated before an actual human child was born. Creating super-intelligent humans would, of course, also have massive social and ethical implications. It certainly sounds crazy and frightens many people to imagine that future humans could have IQs so far beyond history's greatest geniuses, but it is not crazy to believe our current IQ range makes us kind of like the wild chickens popping out a humble egg a month. It may be that our evolution to date has been so optimized for intelligence in balance with our other survival imperatives that such big IQ gains would require physically larger brains not possible within the space constraints of the craniums we now have. If so, one solution to this hypothetical problem would be to optimize future children for larger craniums. Futurists like Ray Kurzweil predict this limitation on what our biological brains can do will force us to merge with our machines so our mental capacities can expand exponentially, perhaps in a computing cloud, without bumping into any physical space constraints. Even then, our species might need some super biological geniuses with IQs far beyond today's normal to write the code that guides our AI, at least until the AI starts writing its own code, or helps make this expansion of understanding and consciousness available to everyone. Human women will not be selecting from among hundreds of pre-implanted embryos for at least a couple of decades, and human embryos will not be mating for significantly longer. But if and when this becomes possible, we'll face a host of incredibly thorny ethical questions. Would the responsibility of a mother giving birth to her great-great-great-great-grandson be any different than to a direct biological child? Are unimplanted embryos in a dish entitled to any rights? Is mating embryos without their consent a form of slavery? But as strange as these types of hacking human reproduction seem today, any child born from this process would have 100% unadulterated human DNA. If that doesn't sound like much of a consolation, it's because we haven't yet begun to discuss the gene editing technologies with an even greater potential to fundamentally transform our species.